Colin, so nice to have you back on this podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me again.
Pleasure. And let's get started with the current situation of the conflict in Ukraine. And how do you see the battlefield right now? There are people who are arguing that if we send more weapons right now, they're talking about shooting Russian missiles by NATO countries. And so far, whenever they're talking about not sending tanks, not sending cluster bombs, not sending F-16s, they're sending all of them. And they've sent all of them. And right now they're talking about not shooting down Russian missiles, which is a new escalation when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine. Do you think at the end of the day they would do that? And the second part of the question would be, how is the situation of the Ukrainian army after the Kursk incursion?
Well, to answer the first question, I will start with the second one first, if you allow, because it explains a lot about the way this war is going on. And in fact, we have to probably to remember, if we read what Zelensky and Oleksiy Arestovych used to say at the very beginning of the conflict, even before the conflict, by the way, because remember that in 2019, Oleksiy Arestovych said that the war with Russia was inevitable. It had to take place in order to allow Ukraine to enter NATO. And this would take place at the end of 2021 or 2020, beginning of 2022. So the Ukrainians had a very precise, precise idea of what the conflict would be. But they had in their mind a conflict that would be won through sanction, through cyber warfare and these kind of things. And in fact, the conflict that we are seeing now on the battlefield is totally different from that. There was obviously from the Western side the idea that the conflict would be non-kinetic, if you want. And what happens on the field until now, and especially with the Kursk invasion, we have a conflict that reminds us of the Second World War. So if we go into the theory of conflicts, and probably I can show you this little chart or table that I had in my book, The Russian Art of War. We have basically, when we consider warfare, we see five generations. So first generation, second generation, will not address that because that's basically what happened before World War II. But significantly, the third generation warfare, this one, is essentially what we observed during World War II. That means joint warfare, in fact. So that means that you take together your air force, your tanks and infantry into one system. And that's exactly what the Germans achieved, with the so-called Blitzkrieg. Fourth generation warfare is what the West has been doing in the last 30 years or 20 years, 25 years, if you want. That's what we had in Afghanistan, in Iraq. That's what you call nonlinear combat or nonlinear warfare with non-state actors, mostly guerrilla and terrorism and things like this. And then you have the so-called fifth generation warfare, which is the non-kinetic warfare with cyber warfare, information technology, perception management, influence operation, and sanctions. And when we look at the conflict in Ukraine, we see that the West and probably the Ukrainians at the very beginning of the conflict had in mind the fifth generation conflict. And what happened, in fact, is a third generation conflict. And that's why you could see the Ukrainian forces taken on the rogue footing, in fact. And in addition to that, they were trained by Western armies who had only experience in fourth generation warfare. So we see that we are here in a kind of, and that is basically the definition of hybrid warfare, when you mix different generations of warfare, and that's exactly where we are. The Ukrainians expected a fifth generation warfare, and probably the West too, with all the massive sanctions that were designed at this, making Russia to collapse within days or probably weeks. And this didn't happen. So they noticed, I mean, the Ukrainian army was confronted to a third generation warfare where it had to adjust very quickly into that. That's the reason why it was so easy for the Russians at the very beginning of their intervention to go up to Kiev. In fact, they moved very quickly into Ukraine because Ukrainians were not expecting this kind of warfare. And after that, after May, June, as the first Ukrainian army collapsed, then they were relying on Western support, Western training, and Western equipment. But this equipment and the training were, in fact, adjusted or were adapted for fourth generation warfare. So, the problem we are witnessing in Ukraine is that we were always in the wrong war for the Ukrainians. And that explains a little bit why the Ukrainian army has so many problems today. And then, of course, we have the problem of how the West understands this war. And that's the second problem, the second stage, if you want. After seeing that we are that the sanctions would not work, that the narrative would not work, that all that would not work, then we have to do the battle as we did in World War II. The problem is that nobody understood exactly how this works. And I just want here to illustrate my point with a declaration of a French general as he was audited by the Committee of Foreign Affairs of the French Senate. And it's very interesting what he says. He says, in essence, the Russians have shown themselves incapable of conducting an air campaign as NATO would have done. So they were surprised that the Russians would not wage war as NATO does. And that explains, that's another level of misunderstanding of the kind of war in which we are. This French general in particular, but I think we can extend that to other Western militaries, they were expecting the Russians would do the war as NATO does. And therefore they trained the Ukrainians for a war that was definitely not the one they would encounter in the field. And that's exactly what you have when you look at if we look at what we have in the media, and even Ukraine itself said that NATO didn't train the Ukrainian force for the right warfare, and that was underlined several times. And very recently, just a week ago, a confidential note of the EU diplomatic service make the point that NATO and Europe and European nations, because in fact, when we talk about the involvement of NATO, we'll talk probably about this later, But we should not talk about NATO, but more or less NATO countries. I will explain that. But in any case, the EU has realized, but notice that we are more than 2.5 years after the beginning of the Russian intervention. The EU notes and that the training provided to the Ukrainians is not the right one. So we see that since the very beginning of this war, we have constantly operated on the basis of some kind of wishful thinking, by thinking that the Russians would collapse based on a fifth generation warfare. Then when it turned out to be a third generation warfare, everybody expected the Russians to do to wage a war as NATO does. And then the people who trained, as I said before, the people who were trained, they were trained by people who had absolutely no experience whatsoever in the kind of warfare which is waging in Ukraine. You know, the problem in the, and I think that was also recently explained in a program by the deep dive of Daniel Davis, Colonel Daniel Davis, he mentioned that. But that's something that it is in my book, by the way. I discussed that beforehand with him. But this is in my book. The problem is that the kind of wars that the West has waged in the last 30 years were, in fact, wars where you don't have the operative level, the operational level in NATO language. But I use the word operative in the German sense because this is the art of operation, or let's say I should say operational art. That's easier. But so the operational art in the last 30 years were totally absent from the military actions from Western countries. In when you wage a counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, and things like this, you tend to limit yourself to a sum of tactical operations. You may have a strategy, but basically your strategy will be the addition of hundreds of small tactical actions. When you talk about operational art, as the Russians understand, the operational art is not the addition of tactical action. It's the result of synergies between tactical actions, meaning that the tactical actions must be a multiplier for operational operations, and operations must be a multiplier to achieve strategic objectives. It's not an addition. And that's a fundamental way of thinking a fundamental difference between the way the Western understands war based on what it has done in the last 30 years and the way the Russians understand war. For Russians, military actions are multipliers, while for the West, it's an addition of actions. That's exactly what we are doing in counterterrorism warfare, for instance. That's why that's exactly the reason why, for instance, Israel is failing in Gaza, because they don't see the tactical actions as multipliers to achieve strategic victory. They just take each action for itself, and therefore it's just an addition of tactical actions. And that's fundamental, and that explains basically why Ukrainians are in fact doomed to fail, because that's exactly in my first book, Operation Z, that I wrote in October or published in October 2022, I described exactly what's going on today, because just this difference of mindset, if you want. So this is very interesting, and you could see that in the Western way of addressing the problem, we have constantly put forward the narrative. And you have the narrative about the casualties, for instance, Russian casualties. And that's it's very interesting. I made a comparison with the estimates of Russian fatalities in some selected Western media. And I compared that with the estimate provided by Mediazona, which is an opposition website. And that works with the British BBC, by the way, to give an estimate of Russian fatalities based on what you can see on the social media obituaries and the Russian press, basically. And in bright yellow, you have the figures observed by Mediazona by monitoring the Ukrainian, the Russian media. And in the darker yellow, you have what selected media outlets, Western media outlets, said at exactly the same date. So you see that basically the what we have in our media tends to exaggerate the number of Russian fatalities by a factor of 1 to 10. And that's very interesting. You see, it's even more than 1 to 10, but it depends. The average is 1 to 10, basically. And that explains a little bit that the rationale for the West, and still today, by the way, is still, for the West, we are still in a fifth generation warfare or war in which the narrative plays an essential role. And I don't want to play here the movie, but that was a movie from a Ukrainian prisoner of war that explained in June 2023 that he was recruited in March 2023, meaning that he had basically less than 3 months training before going in the field. But he was not so afraid to go on the battlefield with this very limited training because he was convinced that the Russians had no longer ammunition, that they would be scared by the Ukrainian forces, that they had no ammunition, that they had no tanks anymore, and so on and so forth. And he noticed, and he explains in his interview, that as soon as he came on the front line, he arrived on the front line, he noticed that everything was exactly the opposite to what was said before he went on the battlefield. So the narrative plays an essential role here in motivating soldiers, but also in motivating our politicians. And also very interesting to see the wording. And here I just took one media. This is the RTS. This is the Swiss-French TV outlet. And on the 13th of April 2023, they said that the Russians had degraded conventional military capabilities. But incidentally, 2 weeks later, in front of the committee, the Senate committee of the U.S. Armed Services, the General Cavoli, who is the commander of the U.S. European Command, said that Russian air, maritime, space, cyber, and strategic force have not suffered significant degradation in the current war. So meaning that we see here that even the military in the West had a different understanding of what was going on in the field as our media. And our media were, in fact, deliberately misleading the world. The same happened when the same outlet, by the way, the Swiss outlet, said that Russia was suffering from significant shortage of ammunition for artillery. While just 1 month later, the RUSI, the Royal United Service Institute, which is a think tank of the British government, just stated that the Ukrainians estimated that the Russian shell production was at 2.5 million rounds per year. So where is the significant shortage? So again, here, there's a total different perception of the of what's happening on the ground. And interestingly, the Ukrainian estimated, the according to RUSI, the Ukrainian estimated that, meaning that even Ukrainians seemed to have a more, let's say, accurate understanding of what was going on than in the West, in the Western media. And very the Wall Street Journal also said, and that's very interesting, that was in July 2023, just 1 month or so after the beginning of the Ukrainian offensive, that Western military officials knew Kiev didn't have all the training or weapons for the counteroffensive. They hoped that Ukrainian courage and resourcefulness would carry the day. So we see that, in fact, we pushed Ukraine into a kind of war that it was definitely not prepared for. And that apparently knowingly, because the Western military has understood that Ukrainian forces were not prepared for that. The interesting thing is that the narrative supported by our media and obviously by our politicians still says the contrary. So we see here an increasing discrepancy between what the Western military can assess on the situation and what the politicians try to do with Ukraine. And that's extremely worrisome, because that shows, by the way, that the what I'm saying here is exactly what open democracy understood. So we had in mind a total different type of war, and deliberately we pushed Ukraine into this war. And that's interesting, because just 2 days ago in the Kyiv Post, which is obviously Ukrainian media, you had this a very interesting article that states that Putin is right about one thing: the war in Ukraine is not just about Ukraine. And in fact, it explains that the war in Ukraine has little to do with Ukraine, but has to do between in the framework of a war between the West and Russia. And that means that the Ukrainians start to understand that they have been misused by our politicians and our media, by the way, to wage a war against Russia. And that's exactly what it's happening. And it's very interesting to see that Ukrainians are today acknowledging that. Even the Ukrainians themselves, probably not the government, because obviously the government, I mean Zelensky and his close circle of advisors and high-ranking officials, are probably still entangled into the official Western narrative that they should have victory and all that, and that they are still fighting for the liberty of Ukraine and blah, 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 and all that. But the thing is that if it was about the freedom and the values of Ukraine and the West, then Zelensky would have signed or implemented the Minsk agreement, for instance. So definitely this has nothing to do with that. So we see that we have this sense that Ukraine is waging the wrong war with the wrong means, with the wrong training, and for the wrong objective. And I think this is that, by the way, this is what I've said in all my books about the Ukrainian conflict. So this very last article from the Kyiv Post vindicates me to some extent, because nobody wanted to hear that so far. And now the Ukrainians themselves are saying it. So there is definitely a problem. We didn't want, the West didn't want to acknowledge the nature of the conflict that was going on in Ukraine. They didn't want to acknowledge the fact that the Ukrainians were not prepared to fight the Russians. And, you know, we have provided a lot of equipment to the Ukrainians, including the F-16 and all that. But at the same time, if you look at the generation of these weapons and weapon systems, you could see that basically there are twice the number of years in terms of generation, twice the number of years as the equipment that is fielded by the Russians. Meaning that if you look at the Leopard 2, for instance, I used to command a Leopard 2 battalion of the same kind which is now used by the Ukrainians. I mean, most of them. I mean, the Ukrainians have received mostly Leopard 2A4 and Leopard 2A6. Some others as well, but essentially these are the two. I have been in charge, in command of a battalion, Leopard 2A4. Now, this is a very good equipment, but definitely not up to the mark when it's about when you are talking about T90, T90M, T90MS. It's definitely not up to the mark. The Leopard 2 tank, for instance, was not designed for this kind of terrain. It is much higher than the T90. Because the T90 was designed to fight on a very flat country, while the Leopard 2 was designed to fight in Central Europe, which is a more hilly type of terrain where you need to have higher tank in order to be able to shoot at your enemy by using the terrain as cover, if you want. So I don't want to go into the specifics here, but It's essentially that. Meaning that when you put face-to-face a T-90M and a Leopard 2 on a flat terrain, the T-90 has definitely the advantage because it's much lower on the ground and therefore it has a smaller silhouette and therefore is less likely to be hit. This, of course, doesn't apply when you use drones and things like this. This is just when you are talking about what we call the tank duel. So you have two tanks dueling, and this is a kind of encounter that we figured out in Europe. But apparently, this is not exactly what's happening in Ukraine. By the way, the use of drones changed also the way tanks were used and all that. So there are different factors. But in any case, this equipment, the Leopard 2A4, for instance, is about 40 years old. While the T90MS is something which is less than 10 years old, meaning that all the technology which is inside, the detection capabilities, the optics, electro-optics, and all that are much more advanced in the T90 than it is on the Leopard 2A4. It's probably different in new generations of Leopard 2. But, you know, this is the equipment we sent to Ukraine were definitely not the top-notch type of equipment. Even the F-16, by the way, the F-16 is something that was designed in the 70s and was a very commercial success, by the way, in the 80s. But they have been upgraded, and even those provided to Kiev have been received some kind of upgrades, but they are probably not, they don't have all the sophistication and the abilities that the Sukhoi 57 has, for instance. And the Sukhoi 57 is fielded by the Russians today in Ukraine. Apparently it's one of them who hit this F-16. I have no idea. I don't know. But apparently this is what the current narrative says. But in any case, that shows that we have a difference in generation, a difference in ability. The British, for instance, have provided anti-tank missiles to Ukraine, which were outdated, meaning that you have you have a date until which you can best use your missile. But these missiles were outdated, literally outdated. So we provided surplus ammunition, surplus equipment, basically equipment that the West didn't want to use anymore. So think that were in storage, that were probably not even the by the way. The Denmark and the Germans provided not just Leopard 2, but also Leopard 1, Leopard 1A5. And Ukraine, as they receive some of these Leopard 1, they return them to Denmark and to Germany, because these tanks were not fit for service. So they returned them directly, saying, sorry, we can't do anything with that. So this explains a little bit that behind the narrative, this kind of gung-ho message, you are all behind Ukraine, we help and we'll provide everything. Well, in fact, what has been provided to Ukraine was not always up to the mark. In addition to that, the problem, because the equipment is very often mentioned, and I mentioned it also as a weak point of the Ukrainian. But in reality, the real weak point is how to use this equipment. As I said, also in your program, in a previous program, I think, the problem is not the kind of weapon you have. The problem is how you use or you are able to integrate this equipment into a sound tactical or operational concept. That's the key factor. And if we talk about Gaza, we'll discuss that. But that's exactly what you are witnessing in Palestine, that the Palestinians, despite having only Kalashnikov and RPG-7 with traceback of the 50s, and very basically what Western countries would consider the obsolete equipment, the Palestinians are able to inflict very severe losses to the Israelis. Israelis having much more heavy equipment, heavy tanks, armored vehicles, sophisticated electronics, protection devices, and early warning devices, even mounted on tanks. So despite all this, the Palestinians are able to achieve tactical success, and even, I would say, even operational success against Israel, because they are able to integrate their weapons into a consistent concept of operation. And that's exactly, basically, again, we had this in Vietnam with the Viet Cong, with very outdated SKS rifles and some Kalashnikovs and all that. You had the Afghans, for instance, with Lee Enfield rifles of World War II or World War I even, and they were able to inflict losses to the Russians during the Soviet intervention, but also against NATO later on. So the problem again is not the kind of weapon you have, but how you are, what is your ability to integrate them into something. And that's exactly what is missing in Ukraine. And the reason why it's missing is that Ukraine didn't prepare for the third generation warfare. It was prepared for a fifth generation warfare where the narrative is a central piece. And that's the reason why the perception management, influence operation are so important in the West to achieve some kind of success, both in Palestine and in Ukraine. That explains probably, we are going a little bit far here, but that probably explains the issue with Pavel Durov in France and all the limitations that are made on Twitter, on Facebook, and all that, social networks at large, because in fifth generation warfare, the narrative, and because it's a non-kinetic war, meaning that everything that is used to be just a support to warfare are today at the center of warfare. That includes the narrative, that includes perception management, and that includes sanctions. So everything basically that you can use to weaken your adversary without going to the battlefield. The problem is that the Russians have reacted on the battlefield, and the Ukrainians were not prepared for that. And therefore, they have the weapons, they have the equipment, they have the to some extent, the personnel, even if it's drastically reducing, but it's another topic, but they have all the resources. The problem is that they have never been able to put all these resources together into a sound concept that would counter effectively the Russians. And that's why the Russians have the upper hand. It's just because they are superior, because they are prepared for that, they're superior in waging this third generation warfare, meaning that it's combined arms operations, joint operations, and the integration between intelligence, artillery, tanks, infantry, all that integrated into one concept, and that works quite well. It doesn't mean that the Russians cannot suffer casualties or small tactical defeats and all that, because it's exactly like if you play chess. I mean, you have an adversary, and you will also lose your own pieces. But this is definitely what's happening. But at the same time, if we look at the big picture, we see that the Russians have the situation under control. And you know, the idea of this fifth generation warfare conducted by the West was in fact to conduct some kind of attrition warfare. That was the idea, but with all the sanctions and all that. And isolating Russia, you remember all the initiatives that were taken, isolating Russia from SWIFT, from the European Union, some European institutions like the Council of Europe, from some even mentioned the exclusion from the United Nations. You had so many things. The idea was to isolate completely Russia and to make it collapse. And also that's explained all the efforts. And recently you had Jake Sullivan going to China for exactly the same reason. The idea is to isolate Russia and to cut Russia off from any a contact. And that's a kind of strategic war of attrition. And it turned out that, in fact, we had this third generation warfare, and the Russians have perfectly understood that on the battlefield, then we could wage an attrition war, but at operational level, not just at strategic level. I mean, also at strategic level against Ukraine, and but mostly at operational level. And this is the change of strategy that we witnessed in October 2022, and that was stated by General Surovikin, who used to be the commander-in-chief on the theater of military operation Ukraine. We have a different strategy. We do not strive for high tempo of advance. We try to preserve each and every soldier, and methodically we are grinding the advancing enemy. And that's exactly what the Russians are doing since October 2022 in different ways of form. And the problem is that the Ukrainians and the West at large has not changed strategy based on that. And therefore, they are still attacking, waging counteroffensive without any success. And that's exactly what we have seen in Zaporozhye in June 2023. And that's what we have seen in Kursk in just at the beginning of this month. So we are definitely in a situation where the understanding of war is essential to achieve a success. And if we don't understand war, there is no way you can achieve success. This is the problem. If we look at the it's in French, but it shows the daily casualties of Ukraine. It's daily. I mean, this is accumulated. It's accumulated figures, and I took these figures only from the communication from the Russian General Staff. So these are Russian figures that needs to be probably taken with a pinch of salt. But at the same time, it shows that on the 1st of September, the Ukrainians have lost, and casualties here means dead and wounded. So they lost more than 8,500 soldiers since October, since the beginning of August in Kursk. So that means that this is a considerable loss of resources that the Ukrainians have done, just because, in fact, they didn't understand in which kind of conflict they are. And interestingly enough, I remind you, because I've mentioned that, and that was said by Zelensky himself, the rationale for attacking on Russian territory, not just Kursk, but also other attacks that you had against oil refineries or early warning radars or terror attacks and so on. The purpose of all that is to destabilize Russia. Because again, the idea is that at the end, it's a fight against Russia, against the Russian government, and with the objective of making Vladimir Putin to change, I mean, to quit, because that's the idea. So wrong war, wrong assumptions, wrong information, and that can only lead to underestimation of your enemy, and that's the worst mistake you can do at war, as said Sun Tzu 2,500 years ago. The worst mistake you can do in war is to underestimate your enemy. That's exactly what the West and Ukraine has done so far. That's exactly the reason why Ukraine cannot win.
Yeah, here comes the question. It seems to me that the foundation of these problems on the part of NATO would be the sanctions, that they didn't work, that the way they wanted to be on on Russia. And right now, because all the narrative that you're talking about, political moves and their talks, the way that they're picturing the battlefield, it comes after the economy of the situation of the economy of Russian Federation. Because if they were successful enforcing these sanctions and destroying the Russian economy, all these narrative would just go a long way and just describing how Russia is weak and we are destroying Russia. And it seems that at the end of the BRICS, here comes BRICS and the importance of BRICS, that in the West they didn't care about BRICS before the conflict that much, before the conflict in Ukraine started. Right now, I think in the West, they're understanding the importance of BRICS and how they can change the game, even with a major war between NATO and Russia.
Well, I don't know if the BRICS can change the nature of war between NATO and Russia. We have, if I take your question from the beginning, the first thing is that the West assumed that Russia was weak based on what they observed probably more than 10 years ago. And had all these sanctions been applied maybe 15 years ago or so against Russia, this would probably have led to Russian collapse. But in 2014, as we had the Maidan revolution and the toppling of the Yanukovych government, the West started to apply sanctions to Russia. And Russia understood that these sanctions were probably just the first ones, and that their economy was not prepared for sanctions. And in fact, the first sanctions led to some difficulties to Russia in 2014, because Russia was not prepared, and for very basic things. I mean, you know, Europe, for instance, banned the export of apples and fruits to Russia. And you would expect Russia to be such a big country to have enough food, enough fruits and all that. But it didn't, because it was probably more convenient just to import them from France, Italy, or Spain, because it costs less and you can have that without making any effort. And the Russians realized this in 2014, and they started to develop their agriculture at high speed. And in 2014, I mean 2010, 2014, Russia was a net importer of grain. Today, it's one of the major exporters in the world. Because precisely that, the Russians have understood, they've learned the lessons. And that's something that the West has totally underestimated. This is the ability of the Russians to react to a situation, to understand. And, you know, Russia, and that's the same applies to Iran, to China, to India, to Russia. These are countries that are huge. And when you say huge, you also talk about huge poverty and all that. But that gives the wrong picture, because parallel to that, these are the countries where you have the highest standard in education. In all these countries, they have an extremely high standard of education. They have a large amount of scientists, engineers, intellectuals, and therefore their ability to change a situation, to adapt to a situation, is enormous if they have the incentive to do it. And by sanctioning Russia in 2014, the West created the incentive for Russia to develop its own economy. And therefore today, Russia is produce its own apples and pears and all that. And I mentioned grain. So they have understood they need to be independent. They They cannot afford to depend from the West. And that's the reason why all the sanctions that were applied from February 2022 were in fact pointless, because the Russians were in fact prepared for such a situation. So that's the first aspect. So meaning that our picture of Russia is in fact outdated. We used to have the picture we could have 20, 25 years ago. And that was the base on the policy and the strategy. And that's a mistake. Now, sorry, I started by the second part of your question, and therefore I've lost the other part of your question. Can you just repeat?
My first question you're talking about.
The question that you, because you mentioned your question in two parts, and I answered the second part before the first part.
The first part was this, the involvement of NATO countries in shooting down the Russian missiles, because which is important right now.
That was part of the question I was answering now. Now your question was divided in two parts. And sorry, I that's my fault, because I started with the second part and therefore I miss a point. But
yeah, the point was in the second question, the main point was how sanctions were capable of bringing down the Russian.
Oh yes, so the BRICS. Sorry.
Yeah, the BRICS.
Sorry to interrupt you. That was the role of the BRICS. And then the BRICS is another problem, I would say almost separate. I say almost separate because the BRICS have little impact on direct impact, let's say, on the Ukrainian-Russian conflict as such. But with the sanctions that are applied to Russia, the rest of the world, and not just the BRICS, but the rest of the world has understood that you cannot trust the West, because they apply sanctions based on what their own interests, not the global interest, their own interests. And by the way, it's interesting to see that normally the only entity which is entitled to adopt or promote sanctions are the United Nations. For a simple reason, is that the sanctions basically aim at influence the domestic policy of countries. That was very clear in Russia, but you see exactly the same thing in China, for instance, or even in India, where you have the threat of sanctions if India continues to buy Russian oil. You know, this kind of things. So meaning that the sanctions are basically a mean to interfere with the domestic policies of countries. And that's exactly what is prohibited by the United Nations Charter. And that's the reason why, since this is defined, the non-ingerence into domestic issues is defined in a UN Charter, it's normal that the UN Charter can have the means to go against that if necessary, because that's where the rule is defined. So therefore, they have also the ability to to change the rule if you want. Let's put it that way. So all the sanctions that have been adopted by the West are basically unilateral or bilateral sanctions. I mean, US sanctions, the Swiss sanctions. By the way, recently there was the Washington Post or New York Times, I don't remember, who made a summary of all the sanctions. They saw that the first sanctioning country is the US and the second sanctioning country is Switzerland. And as a matter of fact, Switzerland has more than 2,000, more than 2,700 sanctions against Russia, for instance, which is a huge amount of sanctions, and Switzerland has never done that before. So, but all these sanctions have been adopted on a bilateral base. These are not UN sanctions. And therefore, the rest of the world has understood that, in fact, the West can do whatever it wants. And nobody will punish them for that. And a blatant example are the freezing or even confiscation of sovereign assets of Russia, for instance. This is something which has never been done, because when you buy bonds in a country, I mean, if a country buy bonds from another country, that means that, let's say, Russia lends money to, let's say, France or so. When you confiscate that, basically you are confiscating the wealth of the Russian population or the Russian state, which is the Russian people. So this is something which has never been done before, and now it's done. So meaning that the trust, the rest of the world has understood that you cannot trust the West. And therefore, you have to find other ways of organizing your trade with partners that you can trust, that will not try to frame you. And that's the reason why the BRICS has suddenly gained traction. And this is in fact the spectacular development of the BRICS since 2.5 years is in fact the result of the Ukrainian conflict. So this Ukrainian conflict, to some extent, is probably not yet seen as such, but I think this is probably the most consequential conflict that we have seen since the World War II, probably, because of these sanctions. And these sanctions help the rest of the world to reconsider their relations with the West. We had all these decolonization movements in the 40s, 50s, 60s of the 20th century. But the third world, as we can call it, developing world, has not really disconnected from the colonial powers for many reasons and at different degrees, but they haven't really developed because the West still had the upper hand in economic, industrial, technology development and all that. And in fact, the rest of the world still relied on the West for essential technologies or equipment. But the problem is, and we have to see the conflict in Ukraine or the development of the BRICS together with the development of another actor, which is China. Because the big winner of all that is China. China was developing, and I mean, this is everybody understands that, but nobody has understood the importance of China, and particularly the West, because the West used China as a cheap manufacturer for their own product. So they designed the product, sent it to China to be manufactured, and then it came back as a Western product, if you want. That applies to clothes, to electronics, iPhone, and everything, basically. It was manufacturing. But today we see that China is not just a manufacturer. China is also a designer. It's also a trader. It's also it has huge company. It is able to design things, to find new technologies and technologies that go much further than the Western technology. Meaning that if you look at the world from a southern perspective, and if you look at the the globe from the south, then you see the West in the kind of industrial decline. And on the other hand, you have China, which a gigantic power capability with affordable prices and non-aggressive policies. And therefore, if you try to reshape your trading relationships or even political relationships, we'll probably go more likely towards a partner who doesn't question what kind of government you have, what kind of laws you have, whether you are in favor of LGBTQ or with queerty or I don't know what. They don't question that. They just allow you to have your own domestic life. They will help you to build up infrastructure. They will not question that. And after they have done their job, they will go back. I've lived in two countries that used to be the major point of support from China in Africa. I've lived in Sudan for 2 years and in Kenya. And in those two countries, the Chinese were the major partners In Sudan, the Chinese built this huge dam on the Nile River in the north of Sudan. And in Kenya, the Chinese built the railroad between Nairobi and Mombasa and other lines of railroad and have redone the highway network. They have done that in very fast work. And once they have done, they just went, period. And when I was there, even these were major project, you never saw a Chinese in the street. You never saw any Chinese coming and advising and being in the government or in the parliament and things like this. They were not there to influence policy. They were there to do what they were contracted for. They have done the job. Once the job was done, they went. And that's exactly the kind of relationship the African countries are looking for. They don't want someone who they say, okay, we'll do this road, but then we want you to buy this and we want you to do that. And so that's not what the Africans want. And this kind of relationship that has been developed by China and Russia, by the way, although Russia is less present in Africa than China, but the philosophy of economic aid and partnership is much more to the point, limited to what you are contracted for. And that's it. There is no kind of colonial type relationship. You ask me for something, I do this something, and then I go. This is it. So this kind of relationship is exactly what the rest of the world is looking for. And that's the reason why today, when they see the way the West is waging and losing, by the way, because in addition to that, the West is not winning. This is definitely losing strategies that are used by the West. So when you look at this from the South, you say, well, why should I have a relationship with a country or countries that are likely to deceive me, who are likely to impose me some policies? And in addition to that, what they do they are not winning strategies. You see? And that's, I think, is what this conflict the conflict in Ukraine has shown. It has put the light on this problem, on this relationship between West and the rest of the world. In addition to that, we see that the I was talking about losing strategies. The West, what has the West done for Ukraine? It has provided weapons, has provided a narrative, a supporting narrative, but has never managed to have any step towards any kind of solution of the problem. And that's exactly what we are witnessing today, that we are advancing into a conflict where the solution cannot come from the West, or at least I would say more precisely, the solution cannot come from Europe. It might come from the US. And the problem, I mean, the reason for that is not because the US is wiser than the Europeans. It's not that. But it's because you have a presidential election and the US realize, I mean, as I'm talking about the administration, is realizing that they are going into a presidential election with basically a failure in Palestine, a failure in Ukraine, a failure with the trade war with China. I mean, it's a failure on every single aspect, including domestically, because poverty is skyrocketing in the US. Inflation is growing, and the prospects in the US are not very, very good. So we see that the very often you see when you go to election, you try to have a success in foreign policy in order to counterbalance your mistakes and your problems, domestic problems. But here it's on every front you have a problem and you have no prospect for any positive outcome on any of these fronts. So that's probably the reason why you see today the US to be a little bit more cautious than the Europeans. And when you were talking about NATO intervention in Ukraine, we see that the Americans, in fact, seem to have a more, let's say, a reasonable approach to the conflict, because they don't want this conflict to evolve in a even worse direction. So that's a little bit the problem.
Yeah, and shifting the gear to the conflict in Gaza. Right now, we've learned that Netanyahu, in his latest comment on the conflict, he said that we are very close to eliminate Hamas. And the question is right now, how much of this kind of idea on the part of Israelis is helping them in order to put an end, or the way that they're thinking that they can remove Hamas totally from Gaza? It doesn't seem that would be the case when it comes to their army, the situation of their army right now, and their economy. I'm going to play a clip from Netanyahu.
Over the years, until we left that place, this is the state of Israel, this is Egypt, and you can see the Gaza Strip. It is not far from Tel Aviv, not far from Beersheba, and it's, of course, just meters away from the Gaza envelope. But we had an international border, which was from the sea all the way to Eilat. That was the international border of Israel. I would like, if I can, to zoom in. And if you look at this while zooming in, you see that all of these borders, the Navy, the Marine border is ours, but the land border is not. Ashkelon, Sderot, the kibbutzim, Kerem Shalom, and down below, the Philadelphia corridor, all the way down to Rafah, all of these are under Israeli control. The Philadelphia corridor, which separates Egypt from the Gaza Strip, will not be evacuated. If Israel will give up control of it, Gaza will become an enclave of terror. When I resigned from the government, when I realized that they were going to do the disengagement and they were going to break up these Jewish communities, I gave my letter of resignation to Prime Minister Sharon, and I said in it that the minimum requirement of mine was to leave the Philadelphia corridor in Israeli control. So it's nothing new. It was clear that if we do not have this route, they will be getting armed. They will create a monster.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if I look at it positively, I would say if they convince themselves, if convincing themselves that they are winning the war could help to have an agreement, that's probably a good thing. The problem is that I'm probably too positive. They are not thinking like this. They don't want to have any kind of agreement with the Palestinians. By the way, when you look at the map that Netanyahu is using, you can see that you don't see the West Bank. Even though the International Court of Justice just said in an advice provided to the general at the request of the General Assembly, the International Court of Justice published this advice in or judgment on the 19th of July, and it said that there is one Palestinian occupied territory, and they obviously consider that Palestine is a Palestine territory, not just territories, but there is a territory. That opened the door to understand what they include into that, because, as you know, the Arabs consider that even the whole of Israel is occupied Palestine, if you look at what the Palestinians think, because the November 1947 resolution asked for a partition based on a referendum, based on the self-determination of people. And this was the way of creating the partition. But the Israelis never wanted to have this referendum, and they forced the Palestinians to quit their territories by force, and therefore the resolution 181 of November 1947 has never been implemented by Israel. In fact, today they say that the Arabs refused the partition provided by. It's not true. The Arabs at that time wanted to have referendum that define the way the country was supposed to be partitioned, not by force. And when Israel declared independence on the 14th of May 1948, it had already taken, in fact, more than the territory that was on this famous map, which was just a proposition, by the way. But this map was not just the base of a possible referendum. That's all. Not the base of it was not a declaration of property to the Israelis. So today we have this situation, and the International Court of Justice recently said that all the settlements in the West Bank should be evacuated, and the land of the West Bank returned to the Palestinians. And the Israelis have done exactly the opposite movement. So far, the West Bank was under military jurisdiction because they considered it as occupied land. And now they are in the process of putting the West Bank under a civilian jurisdiction, meaning that, in fact, it's an annexation process. It's exactly the opposite of what the International Court of Justice just said. So Israeli annexed the Golan, they annexed Jerusalem East, they annexed, or they are in the process of annexing of the West Bank, and are in the process of eliminating the population of Gaza. So we see that the Israeli government has absolutely no intention whatsoever to go into a political agreement or any kind of agreement with Palestinians, regardless of who they are. Because, of course, they put forward the word Hamas, because that's a synonym of terrorists, especially in the Western world, because I remind you that only Western countries consider Hamas as terrorists. The rest of the world doesn't consider Hamas as a terrorist movement, by the way. So this is the situation. Now, so Israel doesn't respect international law. This is from the very first minute it declared independence, the Israeli didn't respect. And that's the reason for the war in 1948. That's the reason. Because when Israel declared independence, that meant that there were absolutely no incentive whatsoever or intent whatsoever to implement the resolution 181. And therefore, that's why the Arab countries attacked Israel. And the narrative according to which the Arabs did not agree with the partition plan, this is totally wrong. I mean, they didn't agree with that. This is true, but that's not the reason for attacking Israel. The reason why they attacked Israel is that because the territory taken by Israel was taken by force and not according to the process defined by the resolution. That's the reason. In any case, that's the situation. And Netanyahu is talking about victory, but when we look at a recent publication of the CNN, that was early August this year, the reality is a little bit different, because what this article says, it says that in fact, despite claiming victory and all that, the Israelis have not been able to achieve that. And in fact, they noticed that out of the 24 battalion or katiba of the Al-Qassam brigades, out of the 24 battalions, only three were considered as combat ineffective. And of course, we can argue, we can discuss what combat ineffective means. In military terms, we usually consider that a unit is combat ineffective as soon as it has something like between 15 and 30% casualties. Because then when you have such casualties, the line of command is disrupted, and therefore the unit, and we are talking about unit is ineffective. It might be slightly different for a guerrilla unit, because in guerrilla warfare, and that's very much what's happening in the Gaza Strip, you have these katiba or katayeb, depending. I don't use the word katayeb because it's used differently in the in different movements across the Middle East, but plural of katiba is katayeb. Anyway, the katayeb are made of several autonomous groups, meaning that I don't know exactly what combat effectiveness means. For a classic conventional warfare unit, 30%, the combat ineffective means 30% less. But for a guerrilla, does it mean 50% less or 60% less or 30%? I don't exactly know, because since it can still operate each group can still operate or be combat effective, if you want, even if there's no leadership, in fact, if I can put it very bluntly. But nevertheless, if we take this this wording of combat ineffectiveness, assuming that 50% of the Katayeb are destroyed, that means that in almost 10 months of warfare, of war, the Israelis have been able to destroy between 1,500 and, let's say, 2,000 combatants of the Israel. There are some other battalions that are mentioned that have also suffered losses. But what I mean here is that what the Israelis have achieved in 9 months is extremely meager if we look at the level. If we compare that with the number of civilian casualties, assuming that there were, let's say, even all these battalions were destroyed, and let's assume it's more than 1,000 men each, so let's assume 4,000. 4,000 is still 10% of the number of civilian casualties. So to destroy one combatant, you kill 10 civilians. And that's enormous. So we see that, because the problem is that those 40,000 civilians killed, and when I say 40,000, it's a very conservative figure. I haven't seen the last figure, but it's probably close to 50,000 today. But okay, let's take 40,000. Those 40,000 have fed the public opinion in the world. And this opinion is more and more against Israel. Even Israeli themselves, they leave the country because they understand that their country is no longer the respected country that it used to be. And we see now that around the Middle East, the countries are today joining their forces, politically probably, not so militarily yet. But we see that more and more people say that Israel is the problem. The country is the problem, not just Netanyahu. And we are moving towards a very, let's say, uneasy situation where people consider that the mere existence of Israel is a problem. We have more and more people thinking that. Because what happened on the 7th of October last year highlighted the way Israel is, let's say, misusing or even disregarding the international law since the very beginning, because more and more you have scholars, politicians, and all that who recognize that Israel has not respected the international law since the beginning. And Israel could do that because it received some kind of blessing from the United States and Western countries. But at the same time, everybody realizes that this blessing is totally unjustified because precisely of the values we tend to portray in the West and all that. So this is what Netanyahu says is in fact, again, something very similar to what we have seen in Ukraine. It's kind of wishful thinking in which you try to imagine a situation and you base your reality on what you imagine and not on the reality on the ground. I'm not sure that Hamas can be defeated, because the more Israel and the way Israel is fighting Hamas just create more incentive for people to join Hamas, or even to recreate. Let's even assume that Israel was able to literally flatten everything in Gaza and destroy literally everything. I'm sure that Hamas come again.
And resurrect from.
Resurrect, exactly. That's exactly the term. Exactly, to resurrect from that. Because people are so outraged by the way this war is waged, that in fact it creates more incentive to react. And we see now the support that the Israelis, the Palestinians have in the world is increasing. And probably that goes together with what we just mentioned before about the BRICS and the way the South is looking at the West. We see the double standard, that we accept things from Netanyahu that we don't accept from others, even from Western countries, by the way. That we, what we call freedom in Israel, is called torture anywhere else, and things like that. But we accept that, and we accept that knowingly, because nothing of this is new. We know since about 30 years. I remember when I used to work in armament procurement for the Swiss government. I was purchasing tanks, including the Leopard 2 tanks, by the way. But I was in the arms procurement, and when it came, the suggestion came to buy anti-mine device to be fitted on tanks. I remember someone saying in one meeting, but are we going to buy military equipment for a country that accepts and makes torture as a legal procedure? It was 30 years ago. Are we going to buy equipment from a country that makes torture as an official policy? You know? So we know that. We knew that. But everything was highlighted by what happened on the 7th of October. And the subsequent lies, because had the Israeli government said, well, this is an attack, we respond to the attack, and all that. Okay, everybody would have been probably sorry for Israel. But it was not what happened. The Israeli government created a narrative of false war crimes, false accusation, based on which they could apply a disregard of the international humanitarian law, basically the law of war, and start bombing civilians. And for many even Jews in the West, as in Israel, it's legitimate to bomb civilians if civilians were killed on the Israeli side. Although it's valid in our laws, I think universally accepted, and international law, it's also a standard that a crime cannot justify another crime. Even assuming that Hamas committed the most atrocious crime on October 7th, this would not justify other crimes. But now we have the Israelis have deliberately justified their crimes with a crime which is, by the way, largely exaggerated and fed with lies for the 7th of October. And the problem is that with time, everybody understands this situation. A lot of people start to understand that Israel has lied. Hamas might or might not be a terrorist organization. Although terrorism, again, it's also important to remind people that terrorism, because in France there was a discussion whether Hamas is a terrorist organization or a resistance organization. But the fact of the matter is that this is not mutually exclusive. Terrorism defines a method of warfare, while resistance is based on an objective. When you resist, that means you resist against an occupation. You don't free yourself, and that resistance is defined by an objective, while terrorism is not an objective per se. Terrorism is a method to achieve something. So an organization can be both terrorist and a resistance organization. But interestingly enough, in France, this doesn't work that way. It's either or. And but that's this either or comes from Israel, because that's the way Israel defines its enemies. And that's all. When we have the same causes, have the same consequences. And that's exactly what we have with Ukraine. If you don't understand the war you are fighting, if you don't understand your enemy, if you don't understand the way it waged war, then you have all the chances that you will lose this war. And that's exactly what's happening. It might be that Israel has killed a lot of civilians. It might be that it has killed some Hamas combatants. But it has not killed the resistance. It has stimulated the resistance. It has stimulated the willingness of supporting the Palestinians from Lebanon, from Yemen, and probably from other countries as well. Politically, I mean. And basically, by achieving some meager tactical successes, Israel has suffered major strategic, is suffering major strategic defeat, in the sense that nobody recognizes Israel I should put that differently. A lot of countries start to realize that Israel behave like a rogue country. The definition of a rogue country being that it's a country that doesn't respect international law. And that's exactly, objectively, it's not that you assume, think or not. Objectively, and that was said several times by the International Court of Justice, that Israel doesn't respect international law and therefore qualifies for the qualification of rogue. And that's a strategic defeat of Israel. The problem is that it doesn't affect just Netanyahu, but it will affect the whole Israeli people. And the people in Israel, in fact, are very supportive to the government. Even if you have mass demonstration these days for the liberation of the so-called hostages. But remember that not all, because I think one was killed by Hamas. And Hamas apologized for this. Because one of the hostages was killed by a fighter, a Palestinian fighters, a fighter, and I think Hamas apologized for this. But all the others have been killed by Israel by indiscriminate and disproportionate bombing. And probably the six individuals that were found in a tunnel a few days ago were probably also killed by Israel bombing, in fact. But, okay, I didn't dig into that. That's what I have seen. But again, for all this situation, international inquiry should be. But nota bene, nobody wanted to make international inquiry for this kind of things, because we know, in fact, the result. And that's precisely when the international community doesn't want to make international inquiry, that means that they know what the outcome would be. And that's the reason why they don't want to do it. That happened for Nord Stream. That happened for the MH17 in Ukraine in July 2014. That happened for the Bucha massacre. That happened for the question. Even the UN tried to have an inquiry for the 7th of October. But even there, the Israeli government refused to cooperate, meaning that we know what the result would be. If the result would be in favor of Israel, they would probably have supported the idea, but they didn't. So everybody understands that today. And that will probably affect the way the relations many countries will have with Israel in the years to come. And in my view, this is a severe strategic defeat for Israel, even now, even if we cannot say who win or is defeated in a war. There's no real defeat in a guerrilla war. But the fact that you are not winning is already a defeat, and that's exactly what's happening to Israel. So that's a little bit the situation. But I'm not sure. I don't see Hamas losing. Regardless of what you think about Hamas, whether it's a terrorist, I don't go into this kind of wording, which is very often politically motivated, by the way. But regardless of the wording, objectively, militarily seeing, I see no, because when you look at what's happening on the ground, you see that the Palestinians, and again, I'm not just singling out Hamas, because Hamas works with about 20 different Palestinian organizations in the Gaza Strip. And what you see on the ground shows that they have still full operational capabilities. That's a little bit the situation. I think the Hamas is definitely not losing. Israel has not managed to regain control over the Gaza Strip. They destroyed everything. They killed a lot of people. They built up a lot of hate against them, but they didn't achieve any operational success, and certainly not strategic.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
This is my pleasure. Thank you very much. Thank you.